Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Mark Little, tech entrepreneur and journalist. Good morning.
Brace by the night.
Yes. So, back to earth. We've been having this rolling conversation about the new tech, information, media, political landscape. And then this week in America, I think a lot of all the stuff that we've been talking about crystallised in this very real way. So we're going to look at some of that now. But last time you were here, you warned us not to underestimate Trump. Were you surprised at the result?
I think it's one of those events, and there are more and more of them in these days, where you're surprised, but you're not astounded either. Yeah. You know? And I think in this case, I was surprised, obviously, by the fact that it was so broad a victory. It's not a major like landslide, but it's decisive. And if you look at us,
and it's everywhere.
Everywhere. This graphic showing every single demographic, bar one or two, have moved toward Trump. You know, dramatic movements in Latino voters down in the border counties. We're talking about 60 points differences from 2016. We're talking about, obviously, New York City, the five boroughs voting in greater numbers for Trump, one in four people in the Bronx. And then, of course, younger men. We're seeing, obviously, a major shift in support for Trump among younger men. So it's the breadth of all that and also the drama of the fact that this is one of the greatest comeback stories in modern American politics as well. So it's not surprising. I wasn't surprised that he won by a decisive margin, but I think it's the breadth of support, that movement, that's
what
something
that says.
Special
okay.
about that.
Okay. So let's break down some of the aspects of it. First thing is, this has been portrayed as a bit of a crisis for the mainstream media.
I think you got to start saying what it really is in terms of the reasons why people voted in such big numbers for Trump. And first of all, it is obviously a cry of pain, inflation being the dominant issue. And that's why, for example, Latino voters who might be on the margins of society, particularly feeling the impact after COVID of inflation, prices rising, rents rising, the price of your bread rising. But the second and third parts to me would also be a certain sense of disillusionment with the establishment, a kind of plague on all your houses. And I think that's certainly the case with African-Americans who felt, you know, Barack Obama came along and said, yes, we can in 2008, but nothing happened. And the final part, I think, is this sort of broad global anti-incumbent mood. It's happening in Germany. It's happening in other elections as well, where people are saying, you know what, the world is moving too fast. I'm scared of the future. And I need someone to make it feel very simple, very strong man in power. And I think that's where in Ireland, why I know we're worried about the economy, I also think we got to stop thinking about Trump as some sort of freak of nature, but actually a change in political climate that's affecting us.
Okay, yeah, because you might have seen Francis Fukuyama, who's a very respected kind of person, been writing about liberalism for years. He's writing in the FT today. So Biden was the aberration, and actually this is a big kickback against the age of liberalism. And I guess that brings us then to the liberal establishment, if you will, and back to the mainstream media got caught offside on this one, didn't they, in favour of basically what we might call the internet, podcast sphere.
Yeah, and I think we give it a quick history. What's happened is this rise of this alternative media ecosystem that is now clearly more powerful than the mainstream media. Now, it starts, obviously, with Fox News back in the 1990s. It becomes a stalwart of a politically charged right-wing audience. We have the decline in trust in media, the decline in popularity of media as social media comes online. And then about 2 years ago, we have Elon Musk buying Twitter and turning a social platform eventually into a political weapon for the Republican Party. But there's also this other rise, and this is the rise of the influencers in our media. These are the people that are individuals that younger audience gravitate toward. They no longer trust the big media institutions. They want a personal connection to people giving them information about life. And within that, there's an incredibly strong supported right-wing media ecosystem of all these different influencers, people like Tucker Carlson and Ben Shapiro, you know, getting a lot of funding from people, billionaires in the background, supporting each other. And then finally, I think this election shows we have this podcasting group who are appealing to young men. These are bros talking about bro stuff to other bros. And these people would not be ostensibly political to begin with. They're generally comedians, people into sports or gaming, people like Joe Rogan. And these are the people, obviously, who threw their weight behind Trump in a very decisive way. So that's the kind of potted history of the rise of this alternative media ecosystem.
And then, as I say, in terms of it crystallizing, right, you're watching Trump's kind of bonkers victory speech, but I was thinking about our last conversation about how Trump was quietly off doing all these podcasts. Joe Rogan's up on stage there with him the other night. Theo Vaughan gets a shout out. Did Trump actually reach the voters more reach his voters more effectively through that ecosystem?
He did, but he also did something which is very interesting in this ecosystem. Like, Donald Trump sat down for 3 hours with Joe Rogan. Now, it used to be, you said, in American politics, you want to vote for the person you'd have a beer with. Well, now you vote for the politician that sounds authentic for 3 hours. And Trump captures his magic of this new alternative reality, which is you just have to be authentic. You don't have to say the truth. Just be authentic about yourself. And then by comparison, Harris looks packaged. So we in the media praised Harris for being disciplined. She talked about January 6th. Well, people were thinking about the price of eggs. She talked about defending institutions. Well, Trump was very effective in saying, take the institutions and the elites down. And finally, the elites were saying, well, Beyonce and Taylor Swift backed Harris. And Trump knew that over in the background, Rogan and Elon Musk were backing him. And that's a very clear distinction. The media were thinking, you know, Harris is playing a blinder. It's a great campaign, but it was a great campaign for the year 2000, not for the year 2024.
Yeah. Okay. So nowadays, an endorsement from Joe Rogan, or even a kind of a softball enough 3 hours with Joe Rogan, is possibly worth more than, I mean, they thought that the Taylor Swift endorsement could move the dial, but maybe not.
Yeah, just think about it. Joe Rogan's interview with Donald Trump had 40 million views on it and listens. And the average audience for the nightly news across all the networks is about 17 million. So you'll just start to see the power here, just in sheer numbers. But I think another thing was that Harris herself is very controlled, very disciplined. And she went and did some podcasting in the sort of broadly apolitical group of podcasts. Like, there's a famous podcast, Call Her Daddy, a podcaster called Alex Cooper. And that was her way of coming out and trying to be authentic, but at the same time, that disciplined politician we saw at the debate performs really, really well. She's the prosecutor, but put her in a studio for 3 hours, and I think Trump has a lifetime of knowing exactly what to say in that moment to make you go, oh my God, he's just said it. I didn't believe he would say it. Okay. And so the rogue, the warrior, the maverick is what fits the political mood right now.
Yeah, and interestingly, Joe Rogan says Kamala offered to do his podcast. She said he had to travel to her and that she would give him an hour. And he said, no, people come to my studio and they give 3 hours. Do the Democrats not understand the new media landscape at all? They're still buying TV ads.
I think within the Democrats and liberals in America generally, there's a sense that, you know, if you go and do someone like Rogan, you're betraying your own cause. This is a person who has spread misinformation. This is a person clearly supported right-wing candidates. But it's not as simple as that. I mean, Joe Rogan backed Bernie Sanders, who challenged Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination in 2016 from the left wing of the Democratic Party. He prides himself on being this iconoclast, this contrarian. And, you know, he said he would have given Kamala Harris a decent interview. He'd want to hear from her. And I do think that the problem is many Democrats will say, don't go there because you've no way of having a conversation. I think the lesson here is that the left wing and the Democrats are not going to build their own alternative to people like Rogan. They have to engage directly because that's where the conversation is. They don't need to, you know, engage with some of the people who are on the far right within the influencer system. But a lot of people like Theo Vaughan, a lot of people like Joe Rogan, a lot of people like Aidan Ross, these names that won't be familiar to us. But that is the way in which media is filtering. And I think it was a big mistake for Kamala Harris not to do the Joe Rogan show.
Okay, so then the next stage of this, we do Joe Rogan, and he endorsed Trump then, I think, at the last minute. Dana White, like the UFC founder, was there on stage at the victory speech. To talk now, he could be, they could make him America's chief marketing officer. Elon Musk is still there with Trump. He was on a call to Zelensky last night with Trump and everything. So it feels a bit to some people like the kind of manosphere slash tech bro kind of gang are taking over America.
Yeah, I think the phrase someone used this week was the broligarchy. That's the new phrase that I'm hearing from a lot of people within the sort of liberal democratic world. I think, again, we can focus just on that group which might be a mistake, because I think broadly the real problem is not just that we have people like Rogan being elevated the way he is at the moment. I think it's a deeper problem of an alternative reality that has been created, a world of alternative facts. And I think I've been, you know, in the world where I'm trying to combat misinformation for the best part of a decade. But one mistake I think we've always made is we concentrate too much on the supply of lies and propaganda and not enough on the way in which there's a demand among people who do feel detached from society for the kind of propaganda that makes you feel good about your place in the world. So, you know, we saw an example during the campaign when a hurricane hit a very Republican area of North Carolina, power went down, and everybody started feeding off the need to have information that cast the Democratic governor in a bad light. Some cases saying the weather event was engineered by the Democrats because it made people feel it made sense of a senseless event. And again, I think that's what this alternative world.
Even though they know on some level it's not true that the government controls the weather.
Exactly.
It feels good.
There were local representatives sharing fake images of young kids being rescued from the floods. And when it was pointed out, these were AI generated, they said, yeah, but it communicates a broader truth. Yeah. And so that's what's happening. You're being invited to join a community that has its own secret truth. It makes you feel good, you're part of a group. And the other group continually through this alternative media universe gets cast as the demons of the peace. And I think that is the deeper problem right now in American society. It's the reason why, you know, voters were reporting that they thought Biden was responsible for the restrictions on abortion. One in five voters thought that. They thought inflation was still very high. It's not. It's been dropping. The economy had tanked. It's not. It's actually doing very well, despite the problem with inflation. So, you know, what was a low information environment is now almost an anti-truth environment in which you choose the facts which ascribe to your worldview.
So that makes it sound impossible to combat misinformation.
No, it's not. I think one of the things I'd be focused a lot on is how the mainstream media, you know, still talks to people almost like an institutional power, you know, like an election night. Sit down, watch the election results. The election results, the viewerships were down by a quarter for the mainstream news organizations. But the alternative media was live streaming on YouTube and alternative platforms. We're getting a surge in interest in it. And I think what we have to see for the mainstream media is a way to transport themselves into a new reality where, you know, and in other parts of the world, like Britain, we had a UK election where podcasting played a very positive role because it was allowing younger people to connect with individuals who may have been mainstream journalists, but were involved in a two-way conversation. And I think the mainstream media, independent media, public media, needs to understand they need to go where the conversation has gone. And they need to talk to young people who are looking for affinity. This person's just like me. Transparency. I believe this already. And also experience of some area that's important to their lives. And it won't be explicitly political, but that's where we have to go. So I think there's a chance for mainstream media to make this journey.
Is mainstream media a bit hidebound by its own kind of, you know, principled rules and stuff like that?
I think we have these phrases like the media is the fourth estate. You know, it's a part of the institutions of liberal democracy. And I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think journalism has to be a service. Like there's a place in the world for a supply of information that has been rigorously tested by a process called journalism. But it's in terms of feeling like we're this institution where you have to look up to us. So I think what happens with younger people, they have this horizontal trust. They look to their friends to tell them what information they should consume. Whereas the older media consumer looks up to the institution that they respected for their record of truth. And that's the biggest change. Most people are looking for individuals rather than the institution.
Okay, so on those young people then, the first time I heard the phrase low propensity voters was from you, and I think you were talking about a lot of young men who might not always vote. Trump made a huge surge. Now, Kamala, we should say, still got more young voters, but Trump did make a huge surge among young men. 49% of 18 to 29-year-old men voted Trump. Was that because of all that strategy we've been talking about, the podcast, the affinity, all of that?
No, I mean, there's a global phenomenon now that's been pointed out that in every major democracy, there is now this gender divide where younger men, particularly in that kind of 18 to 25-year-old category, coming out of COVID, for example, who tend to be more socially isolated, who tend to turn to voices that are making sense of a world to them that doesn't really make a lot of sense. That's a fact of life in every democracy, I would argue here as well. In Ireland, I think we'll find that in this election coming up. So it's already a fact of life. It just so happens in the United States, there's an entire universe organized around the interests and the fears and the needs of these younger men who are facing this kind of social isolation to have a reason to feel proud of themselves. And that's what this sort of bro talking to bro does for them. But there's also another thing here as well. It invites them to be part of like a secret truth. So, you know, we've talked about how memes, which are, you know, the way ideas spread now by images, not by spoken word, they're being asked to choose to join this alternative world. So, you know, one of the biggest memes on the right is The Matrix. You may remember the movie where Keanu Reeves is offered the red pill, which allows him to see the world's a simulation, or the blue pill, he can continue oblivious. And these kinds of words and language are being offered to men to allow them to join an alternative reality in which they're the ones who know the truth about the world and everybody else is oblivious to the truth. We even hear J.D. Vance use that word red pill during his interview with Rogan last week.
Okay, so is what you're saying here that what's underlining a lot of the young men thing is that is isolation, and this is their, you know, in their rooms gaming or whatever, this is offering them a tribe, a sense of belonging that maybe the liberals and the mainstream of society are not offering them.
But I think this reality forces those of us who are in that sort of moderate mainstream camp to say, like, the zero tolerance for misogyny, for the racism, for the dark forces that were part of what happened this week. But at the same time, how do we reach those young people who are subject to that kind of ideology? So that's really where we are at the moment, is knowing that it looks like America was deranged this week and a lot of these young men were attracted by this kind of misogynistic and racist form of discourse. But then how do we address the underlying condition of those people, whether it's the Latino who voted because prices were rising or the young man who is isolated and gets meaning from this form of media? And that's the really difficult thing, I think, for the representatives of liberal democracy, is how do you not normalize the hate while also reaching the people who tend to be the victims of the people spreading the hate? I mean, that's the delicate balancing act we have in our
democracy. Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's interesting you say about the memes. And, like, again, there are whole, these are new languages, really, aren't they? Like, the first thing that Donald Trump Jr. Posted on X during the count was, show me the memes. So, like, we know the image of Trump and the assassination, fight, fight, fight. You know, a picture tells a thousand words and all that. But so language has changed. It's more about just an image, a meme, yeah?
Yeah, it's also, you know, using images that have one meaning for other people and another meaning for your tribe.
Okay.
So the mugshot of Donald Trump the day he was indicted in New York has been used by his own supporters because it has no surrender. You know, it's got this idea that he was resisting the attempts by the establishment to put him in jail. So you almost tend to embrace the worst aspects of the leader. And that's the remarkable thing about Donald Trump, is we watched his shambolic end to his campaign, where every time he got up, he seemed to say something even more outrageous. And yet, the more outrageous it was, it fed that feeling that he's the only authentic one here. You know, he's the maverick,
he's not pretending to be anything. He's not. And meanwhile, Kamala is being parsed on words she uses and all this kind of stuff, on every detail, because what she has set herself up as being better than him.
And again, she was a really great candidate. I mean, think about her performance in the debate, where she got that great point where she explained in real detail what restrictions on abortion meant to women. It was so powerful. She had a moment when she was asked about guns and she said, I got a Glock and I'm going to shoot anyone who comes to my house. And it was like a moment of like, wow, we saw something there that we don't normally see. But I think it is one of those tendencies for, I think, liberal democratic politicians to be safe and disciplined, because that's the way it used to be.
Okay.
But in those moments, you saw something that if you had have unchained that a little bit more, would that have been the thing that could have helped her fight back? I don't know. I think if Biden had not run for a second term and she had been the nominee from the beginning, I think she could have won it with that kind of honesty. But, you know, when she's tied up and he's the authentic one, it just has a different impact on people, the kind of the people that we don't always hear on our own media, the established media.
So if authenticity is the new currency here, so what lessons can our parties, coming into election, or without getting into any specific parties or people or anything else, what can they learn from the Democrats' mistake and from Trump's success?
I see a lot of politicians embracing social media. They want to be on TikTok. They want to be relatable. And I think a lot of young people look at that and go, I'm not quite sure about that. Whereas the young people would want that politician to sit down and say, could you sit for 3 hours and talk about yourself in a way that I could identify with you? So I think rather than jumping on social media as a more theme of like distributing or marketing your message, it's going to places where you might actually have a relatively antagonistic interview, but spend that time, engage and have that conversation. Because politics more and more is two-way conversation. It's not politicians pitching to the voter and they decide. It has to be about a two-way conversation. That's the first thing. But there's a broader challenge for all liberal Democrats, whether they're left or right or centrists, is that the people like Elon Musk are selling a vision of the future that is so exciting. We're going to Mars. We're mastering artificial intelligence. And then we have Donald Trump selling a vision of the past that is so idealized. It doesn't exist, but it was great. So Kamala Harris says, I'm not going back. A lot of Americans are going, actually, I'd like to go back. Kamala Harris is defending the institutions. They want to tear them down. So I don't know. I mean, how do liberal Democrats articulate a radical vision of a future in which we have these existential threats like AI and climate crisis in a way that strengthens democracy? And that's going to be a major challenge.
Yeah. So when you put it all like that, it basically sounds like these guys are telling a really compelling, exciting story, and liberals are telling a kind of a tut-tutting, depressing story.
Yeah, and liberals have become the establishment, right? So until very recently, if you were a radical in society, you generally were left. The anti-establishment forces were traditionally the left. The anti-establishment forces today are generally the right, with exceptions, obviously. But I think that's one of the things. The second thing as well is it's that idea, like in the 90s, I think Bill Clinton and Tony Blair have a lot to answer for because they kind of did accept a lot of the conditions that led to inequality, led to the economic crisis. Mm-hmm. But they were brilliant communicators. If you think about Bill Clinton in 96, his campaign slogan was "Bridge to the 21st century." Tony Blair addressed issues like crime and safety, you know, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. They had a way of constructing language that could allow people to see a future in which democratic values could be enshrined. Today, it's hard to compete with the make your country great again, or the science fiction future of Musk, or the autocratic vision of people like Viktor Orban or the Chinese, where you can have all the freedom you want in your life, you can have every service accessible through your phone, you can't express dissent. And increasingly, in the face of this change in the world, people are embracing simple, sure solutions. And liberal Democrats just don't have the same kind of compelling vision of what democracy looks like. So Kamala Harris talks about joy at our Democratic convention, wants to save democracy, but hasn't articulated what that actually means in this world of existential challenge and exponential speed and change.
Wow. Okay. Now, look, we can only hope that John Stewart had a compilation of pundits after the last few elections there making these kind of very definite statements about the world has completely changed now. And after the last election, Donald Trump will be a pariah, never welcome in Washington again. All of them so sure about it. We can only hope that this moment is maybe not as pivotal as it seems to be.
Go back to 2004, George Bush gets a second term. He goes very radical on his conservative agenda internally. He wages war in Iraq. Barack Obama comes along in 2008. So nothing is ever what it seems for very long.
Yeah.
I think in Ireland, we kind of have to take a look here and think about what's going on. We have a very strong political system. We've got a good electoral system that doesn't reward the kind of demagoguery. We've got good, strong public and independent media. We've got good political parties that kind of moderate things. But there is the kindling here. The grounds have been laid among, for example, the generational divide between a 25-year-old sharing a house with five people where their parents at that age owned a house. Young men, we have the highest rate of suicide, you know, among our peers in Europe, among young men, and we haven't addressed that. And then obviously we have issues like immigration. So, you know, I think we have probably another election before we really need to radically address some of these issues. But it's what do we do? What do our politicians do? And us personally, and I think one of the reasons I love coming to talk to you, Brendan, is I want to make people feel like the future, you are not powerless.
Okay.
You as an individual can choose the media you consume, decide your conscience of the consumption you're making, and don't reward the chancers and the shameless politicians who come to your vote door looking for the vote. I think we all have a sense of power here to hold on to what is good about liberal democracy by telling a new story that's compelling to a new generation.
I'm going to have to lie down and think about a lot of that for the rest of the day. So much in there. Mark Little, thank you very much. We'll take a break.